United States is for Fig Newton. It was named after Newton, Massachusetts.
Oh.
I haven't had a Fig Newton in a really long time.
It's because they're bad cookies. That's so it goes.
Man, you're really downing on a lot of things that I like this morning. Jeez, don't yuck my yum. That's so it goes.
Don't what?
Don't yuck my yum.
Got it.
Moving Wisconsin forward, one joke at a time, this is Kristen Bry with As Goes Wisconsin.
Yada, yada, yada.
Hello, Wisconsin!
Hello, Wisconsin! Welcome to the noon hour of our Friday show of As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry, she is Jane Matinere, and our guest is Mr. Scott Ross, longtime political veteran of Wisconsin politics and Democratic analyst. And we were waiting for Bill McCaution, Republican strategist, to join us as well. But Scott, so happy to have you on the, this is your first time. We've been connected for the last couple of years since I started As Goes Wisconsin, but first time on the show. Happy to have you.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Good to meet you, Jane. And hopefully everybody will be gentle to me. I don't know. Bill must be picking up one of those big sacks of Republican cash that he has at his disposal. So we'll have to wait and
we'll
see.
We'll have to wait. But I guess while we wait for Bill, I would love to hear your... We'd spend a lot of the first hour talking about the biggest story of the day, which is the former president being indicted. And we were asking whether this hurts or helps him. And I guess it also, to be a little bit more pointed, does it hurt or help him in the general election versus the primary election? How are you feeling this morning?
Well, I mean, there's lots of, you know, there are a lot of non-lawyers like myself and a lot of non-political analysts who are out there making their thoughts about this known. I would say this, like, it's a pretty understandable crime. He paid off a porn star to, you know, keep their affair under wraps, and he had somebody launder that money to do it. It's pretty easily understood. So, like, there are people out there, obviously, who, you know, will look past someone's character flaws when they're making their choice of the election, you know, at the ballot box. But I think this is so easy. I don't think it's going to. Trump isn't going to gain voters out of this. I was arguing with a friend of mine, you know, who's on the other side about this very subject. Like, Trump lost by three million votes in 2016. He lost by 8 million in 2020. Like, he's tapped out. There is not, he's not going to suddenly have a bunch of people who were like, I'm rejecting this guy, you know, who didn't vote for him before, who are suddenly going to say, well, you know what, the fact that he got indicted for, you know, laundering money to pay off a porn star and avoid the campaign finance laws, that's going to be the thing that really makes me want to go out and vote for him this time. That's why I don't think it's going to make a difference in 2024. You know, I don't think it's really going to change anything. We'll have to see what happens. I mean, I have been in Democratic politics for 30 years. And so I know that, like, you know, if you set the bar low enough, you're bound to succeed and things can always get worse. So who knows what will happen with this indictment, because he's been able to walk through the, you know, this crooked guy has been able to walk through the raindrops for 50 years practically. So,
and I'm wondering, Scott, and now Vice News is reporting this morning, they're watching all of these far-right neo-Nazi accounts. And, of course, they're talking about violence and putting a bounty on Alvin Bragg's head. And this unjustified prosecution is state terrorism. Respond to terrorism with terrorism. One says, hopefully, it will be remembered as a day of slaughter.
Jesus.
Yeah, well, that's ugly. That's ugly stuff. But, again, you know, this is where that side has gone. Because, again, we have members of Congress, even from Wisconsin, who participated in the January 6th terrorist insurrection to try and undo the results of a democratically decided, open and fair and clean election. So the fact that they're going down this path towards violence, I don't think is surprising at all. Whether or not they go through on that with violence in the streets, I think we just have to be prepared, and hopefully, you know, law enforcement will do its job. And, you know, when one of these clowns gets out of line and law enforcement has to put them in place, you know, hopefully they'll do what they always encourage, you know, black people who are, you know, who unarmed black people who are killed, and they'll just comply.
Just comply.
So, yeah, just comply. So.
Well, I guess, I mean, the most pressing thing, I guess, in Wisconsin, though, is if he does, he being Donald Trump, does turn himself in on Tuesday, that also happens to be an election day for us, a very big election. And so do you see this in a more imminent future affecting the outcome of Tuesday's election? Do you think this motivates people because obviously in 2020, Trump did endorse Dan Kelly. And so there is a connection there, and there is a connection of, I would say, MAGA Wisconsinites supporting Dan Kelly. And so is this motivating by proxy for Tuesday?
Well, let me answer your question by noting this. Like, so back in 2019, when the Supreme Court race was going on between Hagedorn and Lisa Neubauer, on the 24th of March was when Bill Barr put that report out saying, you know, the Mueller report is garbage. And after that happened, which was on the 24th, again, that was like maybe 9 days before the election, the spike in terms of coverage, the people going to Fox News increased. There was a ton of advertising there for the Supreme Court race. And as we know, you know, like what, by 7,000 votes, Hagedorn won. So I'm guessing that this will increase some attention that Fox News is getting, and certainly there's advertising on there. I don't necessarily know that they have enough time to make it change, you know, in the way that it did then, because, you know, again, there was a little bit more time before the election for people to get riled up and stuff. So I don't know. I don't know that it's going to make a difference. I think that the Democrats and progressives have done everything that they can at this point, and I know that, you know, you just see what's happened in the last like 15 years of Supreme Court races, you know. Gableman won by 10,000 votes in 2008. You know, Kloppenburg lost to Prosser in 2001 by like 5,000 votes or 7,000 votes. And then by 5,000 to 7,000 votes, Hagedorn won. So Democrats know that. You know, the operation with the Democratic Party in terms of a statewide field program is obviously well on its way to achieving its goals. So I feel very, very good about that. In a tight race, having a statewide field program is invaluable. I'm a comms guy, I'm not a field guy, but I recognize the importance of field. And that's something that we didn't have in 2019 when that race was so close and Hagedorn eventually won. I think you saw with the Karofsky race, like a fully empowered field program, you know, ostensibly run by the Democratic Party, turns Democratic voters out, and they have a reason to go out. And I don't see the enthusiasm on the Republican side. You know, granted, I'm in the People's Republic of Madison, but I don't see the enthusiasm even online for Dan Kelly. They may dislike Protasiewicz, but they don't like, you know, Dan Kelly. You know, they don't like necessarily losers, and that guy lost already.
And lost by a lot. We're talking to Scott Ross, who's a longtime Democratic analyst in Wisconsin politics. And I think that was because I also live in an echo chamber, I realize, as much as I try to get out. But in my world of posting things online and people who seem very fired up to vote for Janet, I see far less people very excited to vote for Dan Kelly. And I was trying to, because I'm still so new, relatively, back to Wisconsin politics, right? So it's like I moved back literally a month before the Karofsky-Dan Kelly election during the pandemic in April of 2020, and was not here the year prior when Hagedorn won in 2019. And it's interesting because, like you just said, as far as what are the similarities or differences you can see from how this year's 2023 race has been versus 2019, where it was 6,000 vote difference, and then 2020, sure, that was like 100,000 vote difference.
Sure. I mean, there's totally different universes. And most notably, the reason there were different universes was because of the Dobbs decision, you know, and the fact that like abortion is now once again a state issue. And this will decide whether or not we can undo the criminal abortion ban from 1849. I mean, that is just, you know, light and day. And we've seen, you know, in 2019, it was right after we swept all statewide elections here in the state of Wisconsin. And sometimes, you know, sit on your laurels. In 2020, that was not the case. And now in 2023, the opportunity is there to take the court back, something Democrats haven't done for 15 years. And again, like we worked on Supreme Court judicial issue advocacy for like 12 years. And the fact that the candidates are now, you know, that the Democratic Party is involved fully when in the past, like they were pushed out, you know, while the Republican candidates for all those years, the number one donor to the Republican candidate was always the Republican Party of Wisconsin. That is just night and day. They're now fighting on fair turf, and right now it looks very good for protozoans. But you have to, you know, election day hasn't happened yet, and so you have to keep doing everything you can. This obviously could be a squeaker that goes to rig out. What, you know, I don't even want to use the R word, but like all these things could happen. It is an unprecedented time. But what we have seen since the Dobbs decision happened is that fair elections, Democrats are winning them, not just in Wisconsin, but all over the country.
And I have no basis for this, Scott, but I am hopeful that people are just tired of their lawmakers not responding to what the people of Wisconsin want and want to get rid of the gerrymander because nothing gets done. And we've been watching it for a decade now. And I would just like to think that the arrogance of some might be finally coming back to bite them.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that I, you know, and why I think what you're all doing is so important. Is that there hasn't been that machine that can help get a contrast message out, you know, to places outside of Madison and Milwaukee because of the lack of the elected officials out, you know, in the state legislature in particular. So every newspaper article that's out in a place like, I don't know, Wisconsin Rapids or Wausau is just what the Republicans have to say because there aren't any Democrats out there and they're elected Democrats and they aren't out there pushing to get into these stories. You know, communications and earned media is a, you know, 24 hour a day, 7 day a week job. You can't just, you know, try and pay for media when it comes to the end. So the fact that there's more voices and we're starting to see, you know, progressives recognize the importance of the communication vehicles that Republicans have had in place for decades, I think is great for the state of Wisconsin. It's ultimately going to be great for your pocketbooks and it's ultimately going to be great for democracy.
Well, that's what we hope. All right. Well, we're going to still see if we can try to get Bill for the last 8 minutes in the next segment. But either way, Mr. Scott Ross will still be here, Democratic analyst. I have some questions. I have some thoughts on the political ads and if this is just the direction that our judicial campaigns are going to be forevermore and whether or not that's a good thing. And so I'd love to hear your opinion on that. But stick with us. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
You are listening to As Goes Wisconsin, a product of Civic Media. Enjoy it live across Wisconsin, Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. until 2 p.m. Find your local station on our website, civicmedia.us, or on the Civic Media app, and catch any of your favorite shows as a podcast wherever you listen.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Mattenair, and we have Bill McCaution on the phone. So we're excited to have you join the conversation, sir. But we're also here with Scott Ross. One's a Democrat, one's a Republican. Both have been in the game for a very long time. So, Bill, since you've just joined, thank you for joining. And we got to hear from Scott in the previous segment. But how are you feeling about our Supreme Court election 4 days away from Tuesday?
The good, the bad, the ugly. Let's start with the ugly. The amount of spending is staggering. We have already exceeded the national record for spending on a state Supreme Court race. It was $15 million. We're already north of $45 million. And my guess is we'll get north of $50 million before it's all said and done.
Wow.
That's staggering. And you got to ask yourself, why are people investing that kind of money in a state Supreme Court race? So I would start with that being the ugly. The good from a Kelly standpoint is his statewide organization seems to be hitting on all cylinders. He's clearly losing the money battle between he and Janet Protasiewicz. But the base is fired up. And typically spring elections tend to be base versus base. So I think Republicans understand what's at stake on Tuesday, and the question is really going to boil down to turnout. Who's got the better mechanism and machine to get their voters to the poll on Tuesday?
Well, and it's funny because, you know, you're probably outnumbered right now as far as Jane, Scott, and I, but as far as what is at stake from a Republican's point of view, because I think we hear a lot from the left on what we think is at stake, but I guess since we talk less to conservatives, like, what do you think is firing people up on the right?
I that's a great question. And on our side, I think it's really simple. Our founders created three co-equal branches of government, the executive, the legislative, and the judicial. The role of the judiciary is to interpret the law, not to make the law. Dan Kelly has a four-year proven record on the Wisconsin Supreme Court where he interprets the law. Janet Protasiewicz has said publicly that she will put her thumb on the scale on certain issues, such as abortion and redistricting. She's sort of gone back and forth on whether or not Act 10 might be one of those issues, but this is the first time I can remember, Kristen and Jane and Scott, where we have a candidate openly campaigning on the positions they will take as a sitting judge. So for conservatives, this is pretty simple. Do you want a Supreme Court that will interpret the law? Then Dan Kelly's your guy. If you're looking for a super legislature that will undo things that you view as bad that Republicans have done over the last decade or more, then Janet Protasiewicz is probably your pick.
Scott, do you have a reaction to that?
Yeah, I would say this. The first point that Bill made, and I think that, you know, Bill has, you know, definitely has some good insights into what's going on the Republican side for sure. But I'll say this. Here's the reason the big money's coming in from out of state. The big money's coming in from out of state because if Dan Kelly is on the Supreme Court, he will vote to overturn the election of 2024, whether, you know, like he will be a reliable vote for that. So, like, it's very, very important. I mean, Hagedorn held strong for the most part last time, but there are cracks in that armor. You know, the fact that we don't have drop boxes anymore for dropping off. You can put your ballot in an unlocked mailbox, but you can't put it in a locked drop box to drop your thing off. I mean, I think that's the big why people care about this, because democracy is on the ballot, abortion is on the ballot, and I think that bodes well for the Democrats in this particular race.
I'm curious if both of you would agree with me that Citizens United was a terrible decision and opened the floodgates for all of this money.
Jane, if I can, I'll pop in because I only want to say one thing. I was going to let Bill trash Citizens United. We have this money in the race because Robin Voss, Scott Walker, and Scott Fitzgerald changed the laws in 2015 to allow unlimited spending. Unlimited contributions and transfers from parties to candidates. That's why this is. This has nothing to do with Citizens United. But go ahead, Bill, because I know you don't like Citizens, or you do like it. So please.
Well, let me say this. I don't think that the third party money will be decisive here. And here's why. It's roughly equal. Kelly's slightly behind on the third party money, but it's far more equal than what the candidates themselves have raised. And why that's important for your listeners is candidates themselves can buy ads cheaper than third parties can, number one. Number two, a candidate commercial, the candidate controls the message. They cannot coordinate with a third party on what their messaging will be. So every dollar in a candidate's campaign, frankly, is worth $2.5 or $3 in a third party. And that's where Protasiewicz has a fairly significant advantage, maybe 8 or 9 to 1. She's raised roughly $14 million. Kelly's raised roughly $2.5 million in their candidate committee. And I was with someone earlier today that thinks Janet will get north of 18 before this is all said and done. That's where her real advantage comes is on the money that has been raised within the campaign. Now, the other thing your listeners may not understand is how it gets there. This is actually a Republican law that was passed in 2015, signed by Governor Walker, that allowed unlimited contributions to state parties. Those monies can then be transferred directly to a candidate's campaign. Let me give you the most probably prominent example that your listeners would understand. The governor, the Democratic governor of Illinois, J.B. Pritzker just gave the Democratic Party of Wisconsin $1 million. That money then got transferred directly to Janet Protasiewicz's campaign. So why the heck would the governor of Illinois care about this race? Those are things that I think, you know, Scott and I may disagree from time to time, but there are some realities in politics. And right now, Democrats have a significant advantage as it relates to that loophole that was passed in 2015.
All right, well, we only have a minute left. I wish I had you guys for a lot longer because this is super interesting. But I want to end on this. In the ugliness of that we've seen in this race, and we're going to do it again in 2 years in 2025, not that we're going to change anything, but as two guys who this has been your career, is it a good thing or a bad thing that we elect our Supreme Court judges, our justices, or would you rather we appoint them? Yeah, 30 seconds. Scott, we'll start with you.
I am in favor of people having direct access to voting for all three branches of government.
And Bill?
I'm leaning towards appointment. I think this is disgusting, the amount of money. We've crossed the Rubicon where candidates are running commercials calling the other person corrupt.
Yes.
Using that word. We've
all right.
Seen that before.
Thank you so much, guys. Sorry we had to cut you short. We have another guest coming in soon. But Scott Ross, Bill McCaution, thank you so much. We'll definitely have...
And then that magic man, he come to town. Woo-wee, he don't spoon my head all around.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Madnair. And we are shifting gears from the Wisconsin Supreme Court election. Unfortunately, we had to cut them off. I feel like we could have probably filled a whole hour with those two.
Easily.
And now we're going to talk about something equally important, but not affected by the Wisconsin Supreme Court at all, and matters a lot, which is reading and the state of reading in Wisconsin, which is not great. Not great. And so returning for this segment is our guest, Alan Borsick, who is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette Law School and frequently still writes about education at his old employer, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and in fact had his most recent piece published this morning. And I guess I was the one who told you that it dropped.
Well, I knew it was coming, but I didn't know when it was going to be posted.
So. And so, but it is, and you mentioned this when you were here the first time, in that there is a war going on about how to teach kids how to read, which feels like a dramatic word, but... What is the war over? And as far as, is it ideology? Is it political? Is it ideology? Or what is, when you say it's a war, what does that look like?
Well, yes to all of the above. The people on both sides are all the, hate the term reading war, but nonetheless, it's not inappropriate to use it. And it's been going on in one form or another, oh, probably since the 1970s, but especially since the 1990s. You would think that reading would be a non-controversial and non-partisan subject. Yeah. I mean, everyone's in favor of teaching kids to read. Who's opposed to that? Yet it becomes quite divisive. There's two different approaches to how to teach kids to read that manage to stir up people in big ways. One's generally been labeled either whole language or balanced literacy, and one's generally labeled phonics. That's oversimplifying both sides of it. I mean, I've been writing about lousy reading scores since the 1990s, especially in low-income and black and brown communities like the city of Milwaukee. But it's a problem across the spectrum. Some of the strongest advocacy currently is coming from really well-to-do districts. New Berlin's big on the subject. I was in Elmbrook in a school in Elm Grove a few weeks ago that's picking up on this, and because they think they have reading problems. Statewide, about a quarter of all the kids in the state are labeled as reading below basic level.
Wow.
Which is a lot. And only about a third of kids are labeled as reading as proficient or advanced, which is actually kind of a high bar. The basic level of reading is, at least you're on the playing field. In a place like the city of Milwaukee Public Schools, over half the kids are labeled as reading below basic. And that's at all grades. And that's just ominous, not only for the future of these kids individually, but ultimately for the vitality of the whole community economically and such. I mean, what can you do in the work world if you aren't a competent reader in today's world? So I think it's a big issue. I'm very hot about it myself.
No, I mean, it is a really big issue. And I guess, as you mentioned, that you've been talking about this since the 90s. I mean, the 90s was when I was going to school. And I had said this to Jane when we said the preview that you were coming. And I can't remember how I was taught to read. Like, in these two camps that you're talking about is like phonics versus memorization, which I know is a gross simplification of those two things. But I would love to get more information on how both methodologies work. But like, I don't remember. I just know that I know how to read. And so this has been a problem since the 90s. And is it something that has consistently been a problem, or is it like dramatically dropping since more recently?
It's been consistently a problem, especially again in the, you know, place like the city of Milwaukee or any of the urban centers nationwide. And the needle's moved hardly at all in all this time since the 90s.
Wow.
All these efforts, all these, laws and reports and commissions and so on, really haven't changed anything. In fact, scores got a bit worse nationwide during the pandemic period, and have dropped now. There was slight progress from the late 90s to the late teens, and now they've dropped back to the level they were at in 1992 nationwide. In the city of Milwaukee, and MPS, just it hasn't moved. The percentage of proficient kids when it comes to reading has been 20% or lower all this time that I've written about it, and nothing's changed. So there really has not been much progress. Now, the large majority, well, I wouldn't say the large majority, different studies have different amounts. Large numbers of kids learn to read no matter how they're taught, and they become good readers. 40%, some say, 70%, some say. I'm betting you were one of those who became a good reader just because you did.
Well, it was also, I had parents who were very invested in reading to me and making, you know, it's like that's part of it as well, as along with the education I got, and which I don't want to discredit the work my parents did.
These things matter, although not always as much as you might think. Mm. I have one of my daughters was a super reader as a kid, still is in fact a specialist in children's literature now. And she has two kids who have trouble reading. Who both struggled. So it isn't only the parents and such. So say, let's say 60%, pick a number, of kids learn to read pretty well. Then you got 40% who aren't, and they need more help in some way. They need more structure. They need more something. So the difference, it's hard to summarize it. Phonics is sort of goes back to the 1800s and is more sounding out the letters in the in a word, understanding how to what's called decoding, to make sense of the letters, to put them together as a word, and then put together words as a sentence. The teaching in what's it's often labeled now the science of reading is more structured, a little more drill oriented, sometimes a lot more drill oriented. Much more scripted than other things. The balanced literacy, which used to be called whole language more often, is kids basically learn to read by reading, give them books, and they'll pick it up from the context of, they don't emphasize the decoding thing, but they'll pick up a word from the context, from the pictures, from understanding a little bit which letters. The whole language approach is much more popular with teachers. Frankly, it's more fun to teach it. It's more creative. You know, love of books kind of stuff. The problem is that the critics, and there's been a surge of criticism, a really powerful organizational effort nationwide around the science of reading, is saying that it doesn't work very well for these, like I said, say 40% of kids. They need more, and they need to know how to sound out a word. In fact, every kid knows how to sound out a word, but a lot of kids don't know how.
We're talking to Alan Borsick, who is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette Law School, and just published his most recent article for Milwaukee Journal Sentinel on the science of reading, whole language, balanced literacy, how can Wisconsin resolve its reading wars and teach kids to read? And how much... And you're probably not going to have an actual answer for me, but as you're saying, there's a 60% who they get it, and their brain's work in a way that how it's being taught to them, they can absorb. And then 40%, for the sake of our conversation, it's harder. And how much of it, because I always come back to, like, kids' brains work differently. There's some kids who are more adept at math than reading. There's more kids who are, like, physical, yep, touching things versus the creative coming up with things. And so is there, I mean, if we're pegging this as a war between two sides and two fundamental ideologies of how to teach reading, isn't there also an argument that, like, it kind of depends on the kid?
Well, all the influences on a kid, the home life, whether you've got books in the home, the educational level of parents correlates very strongly with the educational success of kids. That's a broader subject than just reading. All the influences, you know, if you're, I heard a talk the other day by the chairman of the Milwaukee County Board. She said when she was growing up in the heart of the central city, she knew too much about what to do when you hear gunfire, and she would hide under her bed. She said, I would take a book and read under my bed. But nonetheless, if your days are being shaped by that kind of instability and lack of a sense of safety and counting on where you're going to sleep tonight or where you're going to eat, that shapes a kid's education. The problem is it's not so easy to change a lot of those outside forces. What's going on in a classroom is something that can be changed. And the science of reading advocates who, as I said, they've been growing in influence and power for the last year or two now, especially, they say, yeah, it can make a big difference what goes on in a classroom. One of the leading experts on the science of reading is at UW-Madison, and he says, no, I'm not telling you how to solve lead poisoning. I'm not telling you how to solve a bunch of things, but I can tell you how a kid learns to read psychologically, and we can learn from that and do better. He's a pretty interesting guy to listen to. There are 32 states in the last several years that have passed laws requiring science of reading approaches or phonics approaches much more, and training of teachers to do it. Wisconsin is not one of them. It could become one of them before this state budget cycle is over in June or so.
Because what is the methodology that is right? Like, how do it's right now, it's more like sight words. Because I have a 5-year-old niece who right now she has her sight words. So is that going back more to, like, the memorization and context clues way of reading? And that's what we're doing in Wisconsin now?
That sounds to me like something you would associate with balanced literacy. Basically, there was this, if you go back to the 90s, the labels then were whole language and phonics, and they've been succeeded now by science of reading and balanced literacy. People realized that things weren't getting better, so about 15 to 20 years ago, the balanced literacy, the whole language people said, you're right, we need to do more about phonics. We need to have kids be able to understand the sounds of a letter, that D makes this sound and G makes this sound. So they added a little bit more phonics and called it balanced literacy. The science of reading folks would still say, no, that doesn't work. It's not good enough. It's not structured enough. It's not fixed enough on goals. So the war goes on.
So I guess, does this ultimately, like, what makes this so political? Because it seems like you said, where we started, it seems no one's against kids reading. And so It feels like one of these things that feels very obvious of, like, let's try the thing that could work. So where is the obstacles or the criticism towards changing what we've been doing that hasn't changed? It doesn't seem like we're necessarily getting any better where we're at. And, like, why has this ultimately become a political thing that feels like it should not be political at all?
I wish I knew the answer to that. In some ways, in some ways, I can explain it, and in some ways, it still mystifies me. Because, like I said, who's opposed to teaching kids to read? It became very political. The phonics side of things was associated with being more conservative, and then spilled over into politically conservative. And whole language was more what teachers wanted, what progressive side of thinking, you know, love of books and love of reading and so on. So it was much more popular with the reading establishment, including in Wisconsin and the Wisconsin State Reading Association, which is the reading teachers fairly powerful organization. When the No Child Left Behind law was passed in 2002 by the U.S. Congress and President George W. Bush, there was a big push included in that for phonics. It was a national commission called the National Reading Panel. It became closely associated with Bush and with Republican politics, and very much opposed by teachers' unions and Democrats. So it became this partisan thing that you were a bad person if you were a conservative and didn't support phonics, and you were a bad person if you were a liberal and you did support phonics. So
we're going to keep talking about this with Alan Borsick when we come back, because it's fascinating and frustrating. But stick with us. This is As Goes Wisconsin. Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Matinere, and we are talking to Alan Borsick, who is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette Law School. And we're talking about the reading wars and basically the not so great literacy rates that we have in Wisconsin right now, and the argument over how to fix them. And so going back to how this has become such a political thing, whether or not it should be, it is. And so it seems like there is a move, more momentum towards going to the science of reading.
Yes. Like I said, there's like 32 states, many of them in the last, since 2021, started 2021, that have passed reading, the science of reading laws. Most of them are Republican controlled states. But there is some moderation in this because people realize reading scores are bad nationwide. And especially, you know, the kids who are dealt the better cards in life do better, and the kids who are dealt the weaker hands do worse. But nonetheless, problem across the board. So it's showing up more in what you might regard as more liberal states. And there's some change in the dynamics of who's supporting what. Is it paying off to go switch to the science of reading? The example everyone points to is Mississippi. Mm-hmm. Mississippi was the first state in the country, I believe it was in 2013, to pass a science of reading law. And over the next few years, at that time they were at the very bottom of the list, they've moved up now to being about the middle of the pack. They haven't shot up to number one or anything, but there was serious improvement in fourth grade reading particularly. Critics would point out not so much in eighth grade, and so there's some question of whether it lasts. But nonetheless, Mississippi had the biggest advances in the country in the last 8 years or so. And so this became known as the Mississippi miracle, and everyone's pointing to it. It's not a miracle in the sense that suddenly every kid could read great. But there was big progress. All these other states that have passed laws, are they seeing big progress? Generally not like that. But they would, you know, the advocates would say it's too early, it takes a few years, it involves retraining teachers. One of the best ways to tell the difference between phonics, a science of reading school, and a non-science of reading school is to go to the schools, which isn't so easy to do. But if you walked into a classroom, you would know right away the difference. I've been spending some time in Cudahy, which is a district that's gone big into science of reading. I'm going to write a story about it, I hope, soon. I've been having trouble getting time to do it, but what they're doing is really interesting. And they had not the worst reading scores around, but not so good, and they were dissatisfied. So what can we do to improve? If I had one point to make here, the degree of indifference of lax attitudes, I mean, just not making this a priority, there a degree of a sense of urgency across the board has always been pretty shocking. And I think now we're in a period where there is more of a sense of urgency that we got to do something for kids. And whether that's the science of reading, I'm actually kind of neutral a little bit on that question, but I'm not neutral on the question of, do we need to make this a priority?
Well, and I guess it goes back, does it have to be one or the other? Like, are we putting these against each other and labeling it as a war because the camps are so adamant that it has to be one way or another versus just the general making it a priority and understanding that it could be more complex than just one or the other?
That's a really tough question. I think in general, yeah, you got to kind of pick what horse you're going to ride. And they are different horses that kind of amble at different paces. The science of reading people would say, no, you can't be a little bit of this, a little bit of that, because it just waters it all down. There's a set of podcasts that came out a few months ago about what's wrong with balanced literacy that's been basically revolutionary. It's had a huge impact nationwide.
What's it called? I can put it in today's show notes.
It is called Sold a Story. It's by APM, a woman named Emily Hanford. She's a journalist. She's not a reading expert. She'd admit that. But these podcasts are fascinating to listen to and answer your question, at least from that standpoint, in a powerful way. They're really interesting. And they just eviscerate the reading establishment.
That's interesting. And so I guess as you were...
And she was in Madison recently, and she's coming to Milwaukee in a few months. So there's interest in having her around. I spent an hour with her in Madison a few weeks ago, and she's become a lightning rod figure in this
topic. So I guess when we talked about Mississippi and it went from being the bottom to the middle, which state's
it's
number
about
one?
On level with Wisconsin these days.
Yes, but which state's number one, and what are they doing?
At least, that's a really good question. For a number of years, it's been Massachusetts.
Okay.
And back in the mid-90s, Massachusetts made some really big changes in its education system, was kind of doing okay on what's the closest thing there is to a national testing standard. It's called NAEP, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, including that they demanded that all teachers of young kids, well, reading teachers, pass a course on how to teach reading that's quite science of reading oriented. And within a few years, they shot up to number one in the country. They also put more money into schools, especially schools serving low-income populations. In 2012, Wisconsin brought the same test that Massachusetts is using to here, and you have to pass this test, at least ostensibly, if you're going to teach reading to like kids through kindergarten through fourth grade. It's called the Fundamentals of Reading Test, or FORT. And it didn't change anything in Wisconsin. So what's the difference between Wisconsin and Massachusetts? To be honest, my own reading is they were a lot more serious about it in Massachusetts. And the State Department of Public Instruction, the institutions of higher education, and the reading establishment weren't really that eager about FORT or any changes like that. So they didn't really they kept finding ways to get kids to pass or teacher candidates to pass the test, but they didn't really put their foot on the gas, and we're paying for that.
Oh, that's super interesting. Well, as you continue to cover this, we will continue to have you on the show to come tell us about what you're writing, since we can't just read your articles to the audience. And so Alan Vorsick, thank you so much for joining us. You are always welcome. This is super interesting. And hopefully, for the sake of the kids, we can start making some progress here.
I totally agree with that, and I'm glad to be here, and I'd be glad to come back.
All right, we'll see you soon. All right, we're going to take a break for the top of the hour news, and we'll be back in a minute to talk about what's been going on at Disney. I would not get in the way of Bob Iger, that's all I'm saying. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
Thank you for listening to As Goes Wisconsin, available on Spotify, Apple, Google, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Please subscribe and leave us a rating. As Goes Wisconsin is a product of Civic Media and airs live across Wisconsin Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Civic Media is a statewide network of radio stations broadcasting local news, local sports, thoughtful commentary, and hand-picked music. We are always streaming on the Civic Media app. Find out where you can listen on the air or learn more about Civic Media and sponsorship opportunities by going to our website, civicmedia.us. We thank you for listening.